Hey, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I am your host, Todd Embley, and today we welcome to the show Grace Wu, Director of Business for the Australia-China Culture and Language Advisory, or ACLA, and a notable lifestyle and education influencer on Little Red Book. Grace brings a unique perspective on cultural and educational exchange between Australia and China, alongside insights from her influential presence on one of China's premier social media platforms. Grace shares the story and mission of ACLA, detailing the organization's efforts to bridge cultural and language gaps between Australia and China. She provides insightful data on the number of Chinese individuals pursuing studies and careers in Australia, and places this in the context of global trends. Furthermore, Grace delves into the cultural adjustments and challenges faced by new arrivals in Australia, highlighting surprising and noteworthy observations. Moving beyond her professional role, Grace discusses her journey into this field and her impactful work as an influencer on Little Red Book. She offers a glimpse into the content she shares with her audience, focusing on frequency and themes. Grace also provides an overview of Little Red Book, comparing it to Western social media platforms and discussing its unique place in the digital landscape. The conversation also touches on the demographics of Grace's audience, both in Australia and China, and comments on recent Western interest in Chinese-style advice through Little Red Book. The conversation also touches on the demographics of Grace's audience, both in Australia and China, and comments on recent Western interest in Chinese-style advice through Little Red Book. Enjoy.
When people ask us where we're from or just some questions about our country, it might be the first time they're asking someone this question, but to the foreigner, to the Chinese person, you might be the 100th person who's asked them that question. So you kind of feel like you're putting the limelight a bit, or you're forced to become like a representative or a spokesperson just because you're from that country, while the other person knows so little about your culture. It can only be a meaningful conversation if you have done some research, or if you have a basis of understanding first, or else you just feel like you're lecturing people, you're teaching people, and you have that obligation because they're curious.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Grace, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Todd, for having me.
So Grace, standard opener, what city are we recording you from today?
Today I'm in the Gold Coast, which is a city, maybe it's a city in Queensland, but I'm usually based in Sydney.
Okay, the Gold Coast. Australia. Whereabouts on Australia? Is it north, south, east, west? Where is that?
Oh, that really gets me because I'm terrible with geography. It's north from Sydney. I would say it's north in my book.
It's north in your book. Okay.
Yeah. Let's just keep it that way.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the show. I wanted to ask you first maybe to tell us and give us some background on the ACCLA. Okay, I mentioned what that was at the beginning, the Australia-China Culture and Language Advisory, yeah. The ACCLA. Give us a little bit of background on the ACCLA. What is its mission? What services do you offer? Things like that.
Thank you. We actually refer to her as ACLA. ACCLA sounds like 1CA.
It's very long.
But yes. I guess ACLA just sounds a bit edgier.
I like it.
Thank you. So I guess as the name suggests, we provide advice on cultural and language aspects of things, whether it be helping Chinese students or workers understand the Australian culture better or vice versa, or just teaching the Chinese audience English. These are the two main parts of our service. But I guess it sounds like there are only these two sections and they're very straightforward. But actually, we do a lot of, I want to say, miscellaneous things, because I also help businesses build the cultural gap. Actually remove the cultural gap. Because I have lived in Australia for 11 years now, I was born in China and I lived there until I was 20. And I came here as an international student, not knowing anything about the culture here, not being able to speak English as well as I do now. It was a very steep learning curve. And I've seen over the years that it's been a struggle or like a huge problem for not only students, but also workers and businesses. So I have just been helping individuals and businesses sort of understand each other by either doing interpretation or helping them prepare for a meeting beforehand or doing a debrief afterwards. So yeah, I do all sorts of things.
Amazing. Okay, thank you. Yeah, and your English is remarkable. It's I would say it's near native. So well done on the learning with that tiny Australian accent, of course, built into it. Now, I would like to maybe ask just for our audience to be aware of the numbers to start. So let's start with the dry, boring data, if you don't mind. Maybe you could share some of the numbers around how many Chinese are going to Australia each year to study and to work, and maybe put that in comparison so we know what those numbers mean. Compare it to maybe some of the other Western countries.
Okay, I actually have the numbers here.
Perfect.
Here's my homework. So this year, well, actually, all the data is actually from last year. So there were 150,000-ish students coming to Australia last year. But that's maybe half of how many that were going to America. And there were 100,000 that went to Canada and 150,000 that went to the UK. So I guess Australia is kind of in the middle. And I also looked at the EU because there's been a rising interest in going to the EU, especially France for fashion, and Italy as well. But also what really interested me was that in total, so all the students added up together, made up 700,000 people, and that's 0.04% of the entire population. So even though we see that there's a huge movement of students overseas, it's a small percentage of the entire country.
That is a lot, is it not? I mean, it does seem like Australia, for a small country, sister to Canada, really, in many, many ways. It seems like a lot of people. Now, I ask you, as somebody who went there in the last decade as well to study, what is the draw? What are people looking for? What are students looking for? What are the parents of the young people looking for when their children go there to study or to work?
I think Australia, for its population size, the amount of high quality or high ranking universities is actually pretty high. We have 8 top universities, and ANU, UCIT, UNSW are ranked in the top 50, I think. Obviously, that depends on which ranking system we look at. And also, if we compare Australia with Canada directly, I do think the temperature and the weather is what makes a lot of people decide to come here instead of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, if you compare, and I think that's why if we compare Australia to America, America takes the win. America has way more top universities and, you know, like those popular university cities are not that extreme in terms of weather as well.
Right. What about time zone? Does time zone matter?
Oh, yeah. I think so. So let's say Sydney. Sydney's only 2 hours or 3 hours, depending on daylight savings. The time difference is only a 2-hour or 3-hour difference from China, whereas I think Canada would be 13 hours or 10 hours behind China, was it?
Yeah, it's anywhere from 12 or 13 to 15 or 16, depending on which coast and depending on daylight savings.
Yeah. And I also think, I guess obviously we're just talking about really superficial things, like really easy things, but there are also factors like I do think Australia as a country is very easygoing. Like the people here are very friendly and it's less competitive. So those parents or students who just want to have an easier time or they're not too competitive would find Australia an easier or better destination. But if they go to America, at least from my personal experience, a lot of them would either enter like an investment they would either enter investment banking or like something competitive like that or do software engineering. But I think most people here do accounting or finance, like commerce related majors a bit more.
Okay. Now, are you kind of north, middle or south China? I mean, are you Beijing? Are you Shanghai? Are you Shenzhen?
I'm from Shanghai.
You're Shanghai. Okay. So what is the travel time from Shanghai to Sydney? What would the flight time be? How long?
I think it's 10 hours from Shanghai to Sydney, but 9 hours from Sydney to Shanghai.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not too bad compared to Canada and America.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit less. It's a little bit less for sure. I'm trying to drive.
How long does it take to go to Canada?
I think Beijing to Vancouver was about 12 hours. Trying to remember. It's something like that. So it's, of course, we would kind of just pop over the North Pole there and drop down. I remember the flight path coming right down through Alaska. All depends, right? But being in the same time zone, interesting that it's shorter coming back north, I would say. Okay. I'd actually like to stay with the work you're doing with the ACLA, and maybe we can dive a little bit more into the main cultural differences that you notice in the new arrivals in Australia, things that they might be struggling with the most. And I'll ask you as well, after you've kind of talked a bit about what those are, anything that is actually surprising or interesting that you didn't mention or about what you mentioned, I'm curious to know what they might be struggling with.
That's a very interesting question because I think for everyone, it could mean different things. I think for most students, when they first come here, the education system is a huge shock to them. I don't know if you have experienced the Chinese education system before, but it's more like if you're in one class, if you're doing one course, then you're taking the same classes as everyone else. But here in Australia, you would do one class with one cohort and then another class with a completely different cohort. So for them, firstly, it's very different. And secondly, coming from a different country, it's almost impossible to make friends because you only see the same people maybe 1 or 2 hours every 2 or 3 days. And I think that's what a lot of international students actually do care about because, you know, when you're thrown in a strange environment, having any sort of connection is important, but there's just no avenue to do that because of, you know, the way uni works. But I think once you get used to it, it's not that bad. But in the first 2 years, it could be a huge shock to the system. And also just the first time doing a presentation and the first time doing an assignment, there can be very daunting experiences if you didn't know who to talk to. And also small talk is a big thing. I really don't think small talk is part of the Chinese culture, but it's something that every Australian kind of does naturally. It's become their muscle response to be able to engage in surface-looking but important conversations. But yeah, it's something people really struggle with. They don't know how to respond. When people ask them, what do you think about the weather? It's not something that would ever come across their mind. Mm-hmm. And another thing I want to point out is a lot of people do worry about racism when it comes to a white dominant country. And to me, at least again, based on my personal experience and based on what I have heard from my clients and my students, it's more the feeling of otherness than racism when you're actually in a Western country, because people know so little about your culture as well, that sometimes even when you're in a group, you feel like people are throwing questions at you that indicate they have no knowledge about where you come from. And that could rub you the wrong way. It can make you feel some type of way. It makes you feel like you're not part of the group. I think that's like a very, it's more complex, or it should be talked about more than it is now.
So I'd like to rephrase that and see if you think I get it right. Because I find that point very interesting. In an effort, and I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, that the natives to Australia, potentially in an effort to try to include, let's just say you, but whomever the foreign national is that's there, in an effort to include you and make you feel welcome, that they care, they will ask you questions. They will ask you questions about where you come from, and they will ask you questions about what do you think of the food, or what do you think of the weather, or what do you these things. But potentially for the foreigner there, this in a group setting is actually highlighting the fact that they're not the same. It's highlighting that they're different in front of everybody else, which makes them feel different.
Yes. And it's not a good feeling to feel different when you want to be part of the group. And on that note, when people ask us where we're from or just some questions about our country, it might be the first time they're asking someone this question, but to the foreigner, to the Chinese person, you might be the 100th person who's asked them that question. So you kind of feel like you're putting the limelight a bit, or you're forced to become like a representative or a spokesperson just because you're from that country, while the other person knows so little about your culture. Mm. So it's like, I don't know if I'm making sense here, but it can only be a meaningful conversation if you have done some research or if you have a basis of understanding first, or else you just feel like you're lecturing people, you're teaching people, and you have that obligation because they're curious, if that makes sense.
It does. It does. And that is surprising or interesting. I wanted to give the floor back to you just on that last question real quick in case we forgot anything. Was there anything more about the differences or anything else surprising or interesting to you that you maybe wanted to mention?
I guess it's also in the way that we interact with people in general. Let's say when I'm talking to you, as a Westerner, you would probably nod, you would engage your body language to show me that you are listening to me, or you will throw me some small questions so that the conversation keeps getting propelled forward. But I think to a Chinese, I guess it's just we show respect in different ways. So a Chinese person might just sit there looking at you, not really making a sound. And that can throw some people off. They might think the Chinese person is not interested, which is not the case most of the time. The different ways of showing respect is a big thing, because let's say in small talk, a Westerner is trying to be friendly by asking some questions like, what do you think about the weather? But it's a question that can throw the Chinese person off, and they end up just not saying anything, or they don't give anything productive back. And that can create a cultural misunderstanding, because both people are trying to communicate, but the Chinese person looks uninterested or distant to the Westerner. And the Westerner might seem a bit random to the Chinese person. So I think, small talk is such a huge thing. I keep mentioning it, but I think it's how a lot of, not just friendships, but any relationships start. They start with a bit of getting to know you. And because a lot of Chinese can't overcome that, they don't get the chance to really build a relationship, whether it be personal or professional.
Now, I do want to maybe pivot away just from the ACLA a little bit and understand your personal story, your personal journey, and how you got involved in this line of work yourself.
I came here as a typical international student. I didn't really have any future plan in mind. I just wanted to come to a different country and experience the culture and see where life took me. That was where I was at. That did maths and education. Just a fun fact, I actually failed math in my higher education entrance exam in China by one mark. And that was basically why I chose that. I was like, this is a demon that I want to conquer. I don't want to leave any regrets behind. Yeah, so math and education, naturally I became a full-time math teacher after I graduated here in Sydney. And I think I was very fortunate to have found a full-time job pretty much straight off the bat. But then, you know, at that point, I was just like, okay, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, because what else can you do as a teacher? Not much. and I guess COVID happened, and that was when – so COVID happened. I hadn't seen my parents for maybe almost 2 years, so I was already very homesick. And then I went to get a health check, and I found out that I had lumps on my thyroids. So I was like, okay – you know, that kind of was just like, maybe in hindsight, it wasn't that big of a thing. But back then, it was the last straw on my back. And I was like, screw this, I'm going home. So I decided to just pack up my bags. But I guess I didn't just up and leave, because my husband's here in Australia. But I was just like, I think I just need some time out. I need to go home to see my family. So in the 6 month-ish that I was back in China, I didn't have very much to do, but I wanted to have a source of income. So I started to post things on Little Red Book. My initial intention was just to teach English, because I was good at English. And I was like, why don't I make some money teaching it? And that actually got big pretty quick. I think in the first 3 months, I already gained $60,000 subscribers on my channel. Yeah. So I was like, okay, this is actually going pretty well. Maybe I have a knack for it, you know? So I started thinking about quitting my full-time job. And I guess it's a long story, but I did quit my full-time job and started doing it more seriously. But in that process, I started realizing the problem a lot of people who live overseas have. It's not just language. It's also just not understanding the culture enough to use the language effectively. That's where I started to do more, I guess, workshops for them to teach them in real life scenarios. This is what the Westerners think, and this is how they expect us to react. And that's worked out pretty well. And I've done that for quite a few companies as well. So I guess, yeah, like what I'm doing now is a very organic product of what my audience have asked from me. So I do think doing this has been more meaningful in many ways for myself. Being a teacher, again, I don't know if you could relate to this, but you don't feel like you have very much control of what you teach to students, and the motivation level is also out of your control. So some days are good, some days are bad. It doesn't matter how much you prepare. It's really like a gamble at the end of the day, whether you have a good day or not, whether you have a good lesson or not. But now I think people come to me with a need in mind, and that's made me feel like I'm actually making a difference.
Yeah.
It's been a lot more meaningful, and I do think I'm making a difference.
Okay. Yeah, good for you. I know exactly what you mean. And, you know, you're in it to make a difference. You're in it to help people learn and grow and develop. And when you're not in control of the situation from, let's say, the client side, which are the students, or the customer side, which could be their parents, or potentially your employers. And then there's the higher level kind of bureaucratic led curriculum that you have to follow.
Yeah.
And so there's just there's a lot going on there. But now you get customers, or you get clients, and you get to deep dive with them, really understand who they are, what they're struggling with, and maybe curate something that you get to deliver that really actually hits home. It fills your cup. It serves their need, and everybody's happy, and it's much more fulfilling all the way around. So that's great.
And I do think, all that happened with when I realized self-actualization is very important to me. And again, that comes from just feeling more established as a person and realizing I do want to do meaningful things. And I think that's been my mission since then. I just want to keep doing meaningful things. It doesn't matter, money isn't the first factor. But actually doing something that makes meaningful impacts, I think that's what's bringing me real happiness.
Absolutely. It takes a lot of people a long time to get there. You got to figure out what fills your cup and then start doing more of what fills your cup, as we say. Now,
yes.
You are, we've mentioned it, you've mentioned it, you're an influencer on Little Red Book or Xiao Hong Shu, and we've talked about that platform a lot on this podcast already. People should be familiar with it. Tell us, you told us a little bit about the type of content, but I'd like to learn a little bit more. And it's kind of cool because we don't often get to learn about how did somebody rise as an influencer, which you started to kind of talk about a little bit, being surprised at how quickly it grew so much. But what kind of content do you post? And things like, how often do you post? That kind of stuff.
Like I said, I initially just started out doing English content, but I realized people who live overseas struggle with more problems than that. So I started, channeling in my own personal experience of, finding what was wrong or finding what worked for me. And I give people tips on how to have an easier life overseas. But also my audience is made up of a lot of people in their 20s and 30s. So I can imagine that they go through a lot of similar mental struggles that I went through. So I also just offer some, I don't want to say women's empowerment type of things, but I do think I am trying to empower women in that I tell them to be more brave as an Asian female in a Western country. You don't have to let your identity be your own prison.
Mm-hmm.
And also I teach them things like how to maneuver the dating arena overseas as well. So all sorts of things, language, culture, just, life experience and all that. In terms of how often I post, I used to post very often, especially when I first started, because once you see the numbers increase, it really just gives you the motivation to post different things every day. But now because I have my business side of things and also just me wanting to find a better work-life balance, I post maybe once a week or once every 10 days. Yeah.
My next question kind of goes along with more about that rhythm of once a week that you talked about versus before, because what I want to do is maybe ask you to compare Little Red Book to social platforms that you know of from the West. How's it the same? How is it different? Would one become an influencer on Xiao Hong Shu or Little Red Book the same as they would potentially on TikTok or on Instagram or some of the other things? So would you mind telling me first, or telling our audience first, a little bit more about generally speaking, what is Little Red Book? And then how does it compare to other platforms in the West?
I think it's interesting that it's referred to Little Red Book now, because it used to just be called Red. Isn't it just called Red?
It was just Hong.
yeah, exactly. I think Red is like a mixture of Instagram, Pinterest, and YouTube.
Okay.
I know people compare it with TikTok, but I don't think it's TikTok, because there's a lot more meaningful content on Red. And like I said, a lot of people post women's empowerment content on it because the makeup of the audience is mostly women. And these women live in new first-tier cities, and they're mostly white collars. And there are a lot of users overseas as well. So, yeah, women users or male users. But, yeah, 83% of the users are female. So it is a very female-friendly platform. You can find a lot of product recommendations and tips on how to do your makeup, how to do your outfit a bit better, and travel destinations, all these things. And what else? Yeah, I think Red started out as being just being Pinterest, but now it's become a life encyclopedia for a lot of people. So they will use it as a search engine for anything that they're curious about, because everything's on there, whether it be entertaining or educational, or if you're just looking for some recommendations for products, you can find everything there. So yeah, I think it's become, at least in the last decade, I've definitely seen more and more people using it, especially people who live overseas. And by that, I mean Chinese people living overseas.
Right. Do you see a lot of foreigners use it, know how to use it, know how to navigate it?
There's definitely an increase of them as well. So I think, like, Chinese who live overseas keep using those Chinese platforms, or they keep using, or they start using Instagram, YouTube, like all the Western apps. But I think Red is something that's in the middle. It's something that not only opens you to China, but also it opens you to Western culture, because a lot of these young women are interested in knowing what life is like overseas, and they're interested in learning about different cultures, and that naturally gave more opportunity for that kind of content to rise on the platform. So I think it's more internationally friendly than other Chinese apps.
What does it take? What is the journey like to become an influencer on Little Red Book or Red, as compared to the other Western platforms? Is it the same? Is it different? If it's different, how is it different?
I mean, I haven't really posted on Western platforms, but I've learned about how to.
That might be an unfair question.
Getting down the rabbit hole. Pardon?
It might be an unfair question, because if you haven't grown to prominence on other platforms, then how would you really know? So.
Yeah, but I do think it's very similar, because, like I said, I have looked into it. I love going down the rabbit hole. So I think they're very similar in the way that you post things that people find useful. So it's either things that they will find useful, or things that that provide them with emotional value. At least that's what I believe. So let's say if you post really funny things, it makes people laugh, so they click the like button, right? But also, because the audience is very concentrated. I don't want to say it's homogenous, but it's a very identifiable group. It's females who live in major cities, who have the spending ability, who are interested in educating themselves. So if you can provide value in that regard, your content will just be, it will grow more than if you just post about your life with no meaning behind it. So I guess for brands, if they can see a need, or if they can see how they can provide value for those women in the category that I described, then it would probably make it easier for them to rise to prominence.
Real quick question, might be a real quick answer, but can you or how do you monetize as an influencer on Red?
Usually it's ads. So you get, I don't think it's the same as YouTube. I don't know how it works with YouTube, because with YouTube, you also get ad money in terms of them not being part of your video. So if an ad gets played in your video, you get money, but that's not how it works on Red. Even if you get 10 million views on that video, it doesn't earn you any money. It's only when your video is actually sponsored by a brand. That's when you make money. Yeah. But it could be very ludicrous. I know some, it usually goes off 10% of the number of your followers. So if you have 1 million followers, that's 100,000 yuan. So $20,000 per ad that you're earning. So it can be a lot of money.
Wow. Okay. That is significant. One last thing. Your audience, you said, is mostly Chinese that follow you on Little Red Book, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. So recently, we both know about this Wall Street Journal article that they did on Westerns using Little Red Book to hear Chinese netizens' style advice. Can you, I'm just wondering if you can talk about what your thoughts were when you read that article.
I thought it was such an interesting article because I never saw it that way. As a Chinese, I never saw it that way. And it's, I know about this movement, and it's actually my guilty pleasure. I read it before bed because it's so entertaining and educational sometimes, because you're like, oh, they actually have a point. She actually does look better after she made those changes. But I guess it makes me feel very... I want to use the word empowered because, again, Red is a very female-dominant platform. We call each other sisters, 姐妹, on that. So if you're referring to someone, if you're in the comment section, you'll say 姐妹, something, something, because we see each other as sisters. So there's that solidarity in there, and you're just like... I think a lot of people use it as a non-judgment zone. It creates a very safe space for women to ask each other for opinions. And I think that's why, I guess, even when people make very brutally honest comments, they are trying to help you. And I can see why. Did that make sense?
It's a judgment-free zone. Right. I mean, and it's women supporting women, and they, you know, that's one of the big reasons that they're there, is kind of what I'm taking.
Yeah, I think it's a big thing on Red, women supporting women. And that, to me, what I saw in the article reflects that.
Grace Wu, Director of Business for the Australia-China Culture and Language Advisory, ACLA. Thank you very, very much for coming on the show today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me again. It was such a nice chat, Todd.
For everybody watching us on YouTube, don't forget you can get the audio-only podcast on all your favorite podcast platform. If you're listening to us on the podcast and you want to see Grace and I and these things that we've been talking about today, maybe I'll cut that out so you won't be able to see it. Don't forget to go to the WPIC YouTube channel, and you can check out you can check out our recording and the shorts that come along with it. But for me, for everybody at the negotiation, and for Grace, thank you all very much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.